Session number 10112, reel 6.
Mr. Thompson, reel 6.
Now, this chap who went to Bonn, as you might gather, was a well-educated man. He also had a political turn of mind. You need to be if you're going to be an ambassador. He was good quality material. And I remember him saying, you see, you British Europeans and we Kenya Africans are very much alike. It's the Asians who are the odd man out. He said, do you realise that the Asians don't play football? Africans do. English people do. He said, they play hockey. That's an odd thing, isn't it? He said, do you realise that we laugh at the same jokes? I mean, you find it funny if you tell a story about a man who falls out of the tree and breaks an arm, gets up, falls down again and breaks the other arm. You think that's funny. So do we. An Asian won't laugh at that. And, of course, there's one thing we must say, that the British trading community here, he meant the commercial community, he wasn't particularly speaking of the settlers, but I will add a bit about that. The British trading community do provide us with jobs and they provide us with promotion opportunities. The Asians don't. If they employ us, they only employ us in the lowliest capacities. They don't give us a chance for advancement. Even the settlers, he said, this is adding the other little bit, the settlers have provided schools on their farms and hospitals on their farms and have trained us, you might say, only perhaps to be tractor drivers and other things like that. But always, with the European, you have been taking us upwards in various degrees. And this was a conversation, in fact, on the veranda of my own house one evening over a drink. It was just a discussion, and that stuck with me. And the other thing was that later on, when I was in the Supreme Court, and just before independence, I was called in by the then Attorney General, no, the Minister for Justice, who was by this time an African, who said to me, Mr. Thompson, you've got to go. We shall have to replace you. There's no job for you here on independence. And I said, well, Minister, why not? He said, you see, if you stay here, you will continue to do things your way. We want to do things our way. But I said, to run the African courts, Minister, you haven't got one of your own people who can do it. You know that as well as I do. So I know it perfectly well. We'll import another European. I said, well, so what? Ah, he said, but he'll be new. He'll do what we tell him. And it just so happened that in the context of this conversation, there was an Asian candidate who could have done it. Just. And I said, what about the Asian? And the minister said, no. No. They have never, ever had our future at heart. Now, that's a hard political statement to make, but I'm repeating something that was said to me. I'm not expressing an opinion on that one.
I was interested in this question of the Kikuyu Church, which you regarded as not really being a form of Christianity, the breakaway from Catholicism, you said. Do you know if that particular church organisation or even premises were used to organise by Mau Mau in any way?
Yes, they were. Could I just just speak a little bit about missions? Just talking my own Kandara division, in the area, and I will come back to your question, in the area I had some Roman Catholic missions, an American mission, which was known as the African Inland Mission, and Church of England missions, and Presbyterians, and this Kikuyu Independent Church. Now, let me just take each one of those. The Catholics were run by Italian Consolata Fathers. We had a problem with them in that they spoke Italian in Kikuyu, often didn't speak Swahili, and we didn't speak any Italian. We often had to deal with our Catholic fathers through an interpreter. But they were staunch chaps. They, poor fellows, were sent out to do a 20-year stint without a break. And perhaps only once in their mission would they get a leave back to Italy from whence they'd come. They were good men, and they did their best to rally their adherents around them. I don't think awfully successfully, but this happened because their three mission stations were really, in each case, right in the heart of areas where Mau Mau was particularly strong. But not in my division. Only once was a Catholic mission attacked by a gang in my division, and then not very badly. But in other places, both in Fort Hall and other Kikuyu districts, the Italian missions were often very heavily attacked by gangs. And one at, I think, a place called Rosho. No, not Rosho, that was in my area. Was burnt to the ground, and the priest was certainly chopped up. The Church of England had really ceased to be the Church of England. They had quite properly followed out a process of ordaining as many Africans as possible, and they had been transforming themselves into the African Anglican Church. And although the Church of England would say, our people will never become Mau Mau, well, they did, of course, but they were very good. And I would say right across the board that in the hard core of those African Anglican churches, they held together very well against Mau Mau. The Presbyterian Church of East Africa, which had one church with an African pastor, at a place called Kihumwini, was very severely attacked. The church partially wrecked, houses burnt, two members had their arms chopped off, the priest was injured. And I remember going down there the next morning and trying to do a rallying job on them. And I was given, I think God was with me. He gave me the gift of tongues that morning. And I remember standing there amidst this mess and these frightened people around me saying, remember Christ in the temple, he went forth with a whip. He wasn't afraid. Don't tell me that Christ was a pacifist. Christ would fight for what he believed in. And I did this temple job. I believed it too at the time. One felt so deeply. And they rallied around, and they, in fact, became almost the best Home Guard unit and body we ever had. And to this day, in that bookshelf, I've got a Bible inscribed from them, which they gave me as a farewell present when I left the area. They were very good. The oddity was the African Inland Mission, when two things happened there. First of all, the moment you mention colonialism, or the word colonial to the Americans, they get into a strange sort of sweat and tizzy. They equate it so much with the myth of their own colonial background. They don't know how to handle anything like that. And although they were very good missionaries, they were very, very straight-laced missionaries, they did have rather a lot of money. They didn't operate on the same basis as the British missions. They used to fly back to the States whenever they wanted money and do a lecture tour and come back with bags of shekels, you see. So they had plenty of money. I say very straight-laced. But they tried to keep clear. They tried to sidestep everything. Now, whereas we had the other churches rallying round with us, as I said, the Anglicans were good, the Catholics got attacked and they too were good, and the Presbyterians were superb, the AIM sort of held a neutral position, which was unfortunately made pretty, had an upset with them, which was silly, but it put us on the wrong wavelength. They had at some time taken on a young African, a young Kikuyu, who had been brought up in a Scots mission. And he had been taught to speak English with a Scottish brogue. And it was very Scottish indeed. He rolled his R's. In fact, he was almost Glaswegian. Very broad Scots, this young Africans spoke. Well, again, this is this business of the white man not knowing anything about a black man. A white soldier, that was a policeman, a white young white policeman who was new, just been enrolled and brought in to help out doing all this, stopped this chap and said, "Who are you?" And this youth replied in what, for sense and purposes, I've called Glaswegian. And the policeman thought he was having the mickey taken out of him. And he very unwisely slapped the handcuffs onto this chap, brought him into the police station, and kept him there for a day. The missionaries discovered this and came tearing down to me to know what had going on. And they didn't like it one little bit. And the missionary concerned said something on the lines of, "You British are always like this," and I took exception. So there was a coolness between us, which lasted, I regret to say, for the rest of my time in Kandara. So perhaps I'm a little bit biased about the AAM, but they were the one mission that gave us no positive help.
But the chap was released.
Oh, he was released, yes. I can't. He just disappeared into the blue after that. I knew him. I mean, he was still about the place, but it was one of those things blown up out of all proportion.
If we could come back to the question about how the Mau Mau used this so-called church for their own organisation.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, it was 1953 that a gentleman appeared on the scene who, I think he called himself Archbishop Alexander. I could look it up, but just as it comes off the cuff. And he associated himself with Kenyatta and the Kikuyu Central Association. And they decided that he should be their Christian messenger to their Kikuyu Independent Schools Association, and that he would go around baptizing converts and ordaining priests for what was to be this newly formed Kikuyu Orthodox Church, which, as I said before, was entirely Kikuyu and very political. And he used to go around and preach that Kenyatta was God's given messenger. And in a way, this man, working through the Kikuyu Independent Schools Association, was tying in the church with the political schools, but he was also creating a new deity, you see. And he was a very skillful cook. I met him, I can't see him now in my mind, but I met him, and I knew two of the so-called priests that he ordained, one very well indeed, because I had to lock him up. But he was entirely a political messenger. He was a self-styled archbishop. He was not tied to any churches, as far as I know, and quite where he appeared from, I don't know. As I say, I'd have to look that up.
Could outsiders, that is non-Kikuyu, go into these church premises, or did they have any system of barring non-Kikuyu from them?
Well, first of all, the church premises were usually four poles with a thatch roof on top. You could hardly call them a church. They were meeting places. There were no other people except Kikuyu in Kikuyu land, you see. No other tribesmen there, unless they were there in some capacity as a medical assistant, a doctor, might even be an African district officer. Unless they were there in some official role doing a job, Kikuyu land was entirely populated by Kikuyu, and he operated entirely in Kikuyu land. I don't think Archbishop Alexander worked outside the Kikuyu areas. He probably didn't. He must have held meetings in Nairobi, but I know nothing about those. But I suppose that if any other Africans had been about the place, they'd have been able to get near. We Europeans certainly not.
You mean they would have excluded you?
I think they would have just shut up, dried up. They wouldn't have said anything which we could hear or understand, or would have switched, which is the system, to some bland stuff which wouldn't be offensive to us, you see.
Do you think that these churches, this particular religion, formed a means of assembly which they would not otherwise have had. A means of gathering together, of organising.
Oh, no, no. Now, there's one thing that it was part and parcel of Kikuyu life, that people could organise themselves into gatherings whatever they wished. As I said earlier, even if we'd have wanted to stop them, we couldn't have done. They were always meeting for this and that. They'd have school committees and clan meetings. They were great gatherers and talkers. There was nothing to stop them holding meetings if they wanted. In fact, although this... I mention this church because it added a sort of punch to the Kikuyu independent school's political activities. It was part of Kenyatta's clever design. He knew full well, and I think this goes back, you see, to the polishing, the honing that I referred to back in Moscow probably, that if you're going to really take over a people, you've got to do it all ways. You've got to preach politics, you've got to preach in the pulpit. You've got to get at them through their tribal beliefs, something we English people don't understand because we don't have any tribal beliefs, really. It was part of his all-pronged attack, really. And I wouldn't single this Kikuyu Orthodox Church out as having any particular importance, just part of the whole.
Was there any anti-Christian component in Mau Mau at all?
Oh, yes. Mau Mau at its very worst, with all its bestial oathing, beatings up, this dreadful business of menstrual blood and everything else. I'm not talking about isolated incidents. This went on madly. Oh, it was, yes, it was anti-Christian. Christianity didn't come into it. This was back to Kikuyu. This was back to the native soul. And the Christian organisations, the missions, had got in the way. There was this business with the Church of Scotland, you see, trying to stop the circumcision of women. Missions were getting in the way. Missions were teaching foreign ideas. And, in fact, the missions were. Even at that time, I was very disturbed by the way in which the Church of England, through the African... Anglican Church, would insist that if an African wanted to become a member of the church, a convert, he had to take a Christian name. Now that meant an English name. The names we have in the Bible, anglicised names. They had to make a positive step, as it were. Why couldn't Kimani and Durango be baptised Kimani? It was his first name. Why did he suddenly have to call himself Reuben and Durango Kimani? They didn't like this. Another thing is, you see, the Kikuyu wealth, much of Kikuyu wealth was in wives. A man certainly wanted more than one wife, more than two if he possibly could. Polygamy was the order of the day. This is part of their life, nothing wrong with it. But the mission said, no, Christianity says you may only have one wife. And if we find out that you've had two, you will have committed adultery and we will throw you out. And the number of people who were thrown out of the church because they'd taken second wives was quite astonishing. And they were very bitter about this. I think the church had a lot to contribute to much of the ill feeling. They didn't do this deliberately. They saw this as their Christian duty, of course. And later on... Later on, the churches, especially as they Africanized, learned to accept this. And I don't know today, but I can hardly imagine that polygamy would be an issue and that a chap who took a second wife would be accused of committing adultery.
Was that disemboweled goat on the altar an attempt to desecrate a church, a symbol of anti-Christian Christianity?
I would hesitate to say yes. I would suppose yes, but it was certainly an attempt to frighten people away from that church. Fine distinction there, probably.
Do you think that the Mau Mau was rural or urban in origin? Because you've also talked about, on the one hand Nairobi and on the other hand the villages.
Oh, rural. Very definitely rural, because the land as the heart of all Kikuyu life. And any lad or man who went away to work in Nairobi, they might become, this convenient word, detribalized. They might hanker after the bright lights, but deep within them was the desire for Kikuyu land. It was amongst the country people, the bulk of the Kikuyu, the customary practices and customary beliefs were at their deepest. Oh yes, essentially rural. And Kenyatta focused on this. He used the townie to do his work. He used the channels which towns provide to disseminate propaganda. But one has to remember the propaganda was aimed at the people in the bush, in the country, on the land.
Were there any other roles of the urban area of Nairobi, apart from the ones you've just mentioned, in Mau Mau?
I'm very sorry that I can't answer your question. I would be fabricating if I did, because the truth of this is that from 1951 onwards, we were so busy thinking about life in the district, so worried about what was beginning to happen and becoming so immersed in it. Quite honestly, other than what we got in intelligence reports and reading in the paper, we didn't have time to think about Nairobi, except insofar as its effect on us and what propaganda was coming out and what they were doing. I'd hesitate to answer your question. In a sense, we became individual experts on our own areas, each area being different in some way.
You talked about the killing of children. Why did they resort to methods like that, which one would have thought would only alienate the hearts and minds?
I don't know. I never worked out, because they love children, and yet the number of kids I saw decapitated and disemboweled, they were forever doing it in gangs. It was a sort of strange bloodlust. It got out of control, I think. You see, I think one has to go back to Kikuyu custom. Now, I refer to there being seven clans. Everything the Kikuyu did was in seven. The head council of the original Kikuyu Association had been seven members. Everything was based on seven. There'd be seven subcommittees, seven of each of these. Everything went down in sevens. And there was a structure there, rather like the structure that they use when they base their oathing on our structure. And when we picked up Kenyatta at the outbreak of the emergency, and the leading seven, and the next groups of sevens below them, which brought the sort of first total of arrest to around the 80 mark somewhere, it was as if the third 11 had come into bowl. And this went on all the time. And so as we isolated and picked up or spotted or devitalised the next top group, another group came in, and the quality of each replacement group was getting lower and lower. So that your gang leaders, who called themselves field marshals and generals, were petty criminals. The biggest gang leader in my area to start off with, General Marwe. General Marwe was a petty thief and a thug. So the quality all the time was going down. So those who were operating the gangs and fighting and boasting of their macho prowess and all the rest of it were becoming lower grade material all the time. And when the bloodlust is up and you're wielding machetes and you're being shot at in war, you don't stop to question. And their task, you see, was to frighten their people. Not us. If they could kill us or get rid of us in the process, that was a bonus. Their job was to control their people. This was Kenyatta's message. Control the people, and we can control the country.
So killing the children could have been a deliberate act of terror?
Well, they certainly killed them in the early days, so I think, yes, it was a deliberate act of terror.
On the same question of hearts and minds, you said that some of these disgusting oaths alienated some of the Kikuyu. Why then do you think that they did it, the Mau Mau?
Well, one of my chiefs said to me, and he was a very wise man, he said, you know, Varna, the trouble with people, he put this, this was all in Kikuyu, but I'll put in a sort of simplified version. He said, you know, Varna, the trouble with people is that 90% are sheep and goats. You can drive them anywhere. He said, 4% are bad. You've got to beware of them. 4% are good, and they're usually sort of pretty nice, but often ineffective people. He said, it's the 2% you have to go for. If those 2% join the baddies, then you've got enough power to drive the sheep and goats. It's that 2% that you've got to work on and swing them to the good side to give enough strength to the good side to drive the herd. Now, I think herein lies the secret, that most people under pressure are a herd. Kenyatta knew this. He knew that he had a nucleus of drivers, he could drive the herd. And the herd went. They got caught up in it, you see. At first, the first oaths were relatively innocuous. I will not tell secrets to the European. I will not do this. I will not sell my land to a European. Incidentally, the laws forbade them to sell land to Europeans. Europeans couldn't buy Kikuyu land, or any African land. The African land, there was an African land ordinance which forbade this. But this is beside the point. This was simple stuff, you see. This is getting on the bandwagon. Let's go and oath, lads. Let's have a bit of fun down the front tonight and go and have a bit of oathing on the pier type of thing. And then it gets a little more serious. The heavy mob begins to move in. And they say, unless you do this, well, you don't want an uproar, do you? So you do a little bit more. You don't tell Dad and Mum. Or you don't tell your relatives. Or you don't let on. You're feeling perhaps a little bit dubious about it, a little self-conscious, a little ashamed, perhaps. And then the pressure is put on further. And if this time the pressure says, we're going to tell on you, unless, and so the pressure grows and grows and grows, and you come back to being corralled, caught up before you know what's happening. It's not a simple case of individual decision. It's being swept with the tide. And remember, tide first comes in very slowly. And you can get the tide just lapping at your toes, and in no time at all it can be around your knees and around your waist. This is what happens.
So you mean it had a kind of self-generating momentum?
Yes.
Did you yourselves, as part of the administration, try to identify this so-called 2%, particular individuals who you wanted to win over?
We did eventually, but at first, you see, we were relying. Life was so pleasant. Life was so peaceful. The chiefs were good. They went about their business. The headmen were nice folk. You've got nice pastors in the churches and headmasters of local schools you called on. It was all going very nicely, thank you. And we, like the Kikuyu, got sort of swept off our feet by the tide to a certain extent. And then, much to our horror, we discovered that so many of these nice, smiling people were, in fact, members of Mau Mau. Who could we trust? It took us time to find out those we could trust. Or those, in a sense, we could blackmail enough so that we could trust them. By that, I mean, take a man who's been a Mau Mau oather. But as...